Welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast. I'm Modern Drummer's CEO, publisher, David Frangioni, my co-host, Billy Amendola, and we're here featuring the world's most prolific drummers, listening to what they have to say, and bringing to you from inside the studio, the world of drumming. Billy?
Hello, everyone. Billy Amendola. Tune in to some really interesting facts on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Get easier. Ooh, child, things to get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things to get brighter.
Welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast with my co-host, Billy Amendola. And this is really exciting because we're going to be talking about the Soul Station, Paul Stanley's Soul Station record that's just been released. And we have the drummer and percussionist, none other than, of course, Eric Singer and Ray Islas. Welcome, guys.
Welcome, guys. Welcome, welcome.
See you guys.
We're the Siamese twins of drums, but right now we're separated.
Yeah. For those who don't know, of course, you know, Eric has been the drummer in Kiss for the last how many years?
I don't know. I can't count that high. Remember, I'm a drummer, Billy.
This is
you can only count to four. One, two, three, four.
Yeah. For a lot of years, anyway. For those that could be living under a rock before that, of course, he was with Alice Cooper. And Ray is the percussionist in Chicago at this time. And before that, I mean, he's played with everybody, Jennifer Lopez, Backstreet Boys. I mean, he's been on the scene for a long time. And he's one of my favorite percussion players. Eric's one of my favorites, not only drummers, but singers.
So, guys, tell us about the Soul Station project. So it started out playing live for a little bit. And now you have the debut album out, which Billy and I are huge fans of the record, which we'll get into in a second. So take us through a little bit of the timeline here and then how we got to the record, and then we'll talk about the record.
Let me say something about that. So check this out. This is how crazy it was for me. It's a Saturday morning and me and my daughter are hanging out, right? And it happened to be record store day, you know, like where you go to mom and pop record stores and, you know, so I said,
wait in line.
Say what?
And wait in line.
Yeah, exactly. But this was 5 years ago. So we went to the little mom and pop record store, and I'm showing my daughter all the albums that I used to have, like own, right? So I, you know, this is the Led Zeppelin album. And I said, oh, look at this. So I pulled out Kiss Alive 2, you know, and she kind of jumped back because, you know, all your faces are right on the cover of Kiss Alive 2. So I started naming them, like, this is, you know, Paul, blah, 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 blah. And so then I put the album away. Dude, an hour later, my phone rings and I'm looking at it and it says, not blocked, but you know,
unknown caller.
Unknown caller.
Unknown caller.
And I never answer those. I never answer those. I just thought, well, I'll hit it. Boom. Hello. Hi, can I speak to Ray? And I said, yeah. And he goes, hi, this is Paul Stanley. Sean Hurley gave me your number and I'm wondering if you're available for a gig I'm doing at my son's school. And, you know, and I was like, Paul Stanley, like the Paul Stanley. And then I thought, no, Paul's not going to be calling me up. Right. And as he's talking, I'm recognizing his voice. Like, this is fucking Paul Stanley. And he's like, okay, so is this your cell number? I said, yeah. And he goes, great. Can you do the gig? I said, of course. And he goes, yeah, Eric's on the gig. It's a fun band, but we're doing a lot of old Motown stuff. It's something I've always been wanting to do. And it's going to be a blast. I'm going to text you my cell number and email address. And he goes, we're in South America right now. And we're about to hit stage. So I'll call you when I get back into town. And I was like, okay. And hung up the phone. And I was like, what the hell? That was Paul Stanley, you know? A week later, I meet Eric at rehearsal, you know, where the first time first time meeting the guys, right? Though, I mean, I knew the drummer, the keyboard player, the musical director, Alex Andreoni and Sean, but that was it. You know, I knew Hoffa too, the guitar player, but we just instantly with Eric, me and Eric gelled instantly, like drum and percussion as if we've been playing forever, you know, and it was just pocket. It was pocket.
Why do you think that is, Eric? Why'd you guys gel so quickly?
Well, I think it has to just do with people listening to each other more than anything. I mean, there is a certain feel thing involved, obviously, that people, like they say, the intangibles, you know, the je ne sais quoi, the little things that you can't put into words. But it really comes down to, I think, I always have open ears, open eyes. So I really try to listen to everybody in the whole band. And then I realize, okay, I need to play with him. You know, and I'm not following him. He's not following me. We're playing together. I got to tell you, it really goes back to me. I learned a lesson when I saw the Doobie Brothers twice, like in 80 and 81. And the Doobie Brothers had two drummers and a percussionist in the middle. One thing I walked away from the first time seeing them was, wow, this groove at tempo was so deep and locked in. Doesn't matter, the band is not going to pull them off their mark. They are going to hold the fort down. So, and I noticed that they played more simplified, because together you create a bigger sound by playing more simple, and then each person fills a certain part of that percussion landscape, if you will. And I think by playing simple, listening to each other, you can learn to kind of interweave and then lock in better. And then you create this bed or foundation for the band that's undeniable. And it's not going anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great, yeah. Well, like you said, either it gels right away or it don't. And you can know right away, you know, if it's going to gel or not. And both of you guys, the credit that both of you guys, you just know how to play for songs. You know, as much as like you can wail on the timbales and you can play all this Latin off rhythm stuff, and Eric, because you're a vocalist, you really know how to play for a song, because you know what makes a song. So musically, you guys are musical players, so you're automatically making music together, and it, you know, that you can't beat that combination when that happens.
It's that you said something very important right there, Billy, playing for the song, and that's exactly what I noticed with Eric, because I remember at one of the rehearsals, Eric was like, well, I'm gonna not play too much hi-hat because you're playing the tambourine, and I don't, you know, you're covering like that hi-hat part with the tambourine or the shaker, and I was like, that's how the glue happens. You know, and when you say playing for the song, it's so true. I've done sessions in my studio where I listen back and I'm thinking, I'm too busy. Let me redo the congas, or let me not play the slap on the conga, because right, the drums are handling the two and the four. If it's not a Latin tune, you know, then I call it the air slap or the air hit of the tambourine. So it's not extra. It's just, you know, like,
because you're still giving it the feel.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what, you know, we didn't even have to tell each other to do that. That just happened automatically.
So he's right. We just played. I think we both were mature and seasoned enough, because I think those are two operative words that you need to always think about. You know, a lot of times people say, why don't you play more crazy like you did in the earlier days of Kiss? And I, you know, it goes to what Billy's point about, once I started singing more and more and more, I started understanding it from leaving the holes and, you know, not stepping on things and, you know, being more complimentary with, you know, and being just holding down the fort, being more, you know, do the job what the drummer is there to do, which is kind of keep time and hold it together. And especially when you play with a percussionist, that percussionist, if they're good like Ray, they know how to fill all the holes and be complimentary with the, not only the sounds, but the accents and how they approach it musically. It's almost like you need to play less. It's, when you have this big of a band, this many people, if it's a power trio, yeah, you could fill it up more, and you know, because you need to create more sound, if you will. But with a horn section and a bunch of other people, you need to just hold it down. And I think the one thing that we tried to do when we first started playing these cover songs, one thing I noticed, I went online and listened to bands playing those versions, even some of the artists themselves, they weren't the artists that played on the records, obviously, but guys, how they were playing it live. And I noticed, wow, they're playing some of these songs really fast, or the drummer's not even playing the same beat that's on the original version. So I made it a point to go, hey, I got to make sure that I'm playing these parts as close to where they originally were played, in the proximity of the right tempos and all that. Because I, you know, I'm not like most of these other guys. Ray will tell you, like Sean Hurley and Alex and Rafa and all these guys are more yo cats. They come in, they can listen to something a couple times, make a chart, and kind of fake their way through it. And we call it faking. You know, it was an old terminology that musicians used to say when they don't really know a song, but they have enough musical ability and aptitude that they can kind of fake their way through it. And because they're good listeners, and usually when they're very experienced, they know how to kind of, you know, I did a lot of casuals growing up. So you'd have sometimes a different horn player on the gig, and you know, my dad would call out the tunes and say, like, you know, whether it's two sharps or, you know, what key it's in. And you had to play any song in any key on the spot by memory. Yeah. So you know, I learned to do things by memory.
You just took my question. You read my mind, because I was going to ask you about going back to those songs. Like, were those songs part of your DNA, and did you go back and listen to them? And that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, of course, are you familiar with Earl Young?
Earl Young?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so Earl Young was the drummer in the Sound of Philadelphia, the TSOP. Oh, okay. and MFSB at one point. So they did all the songs that you guys did. He pretty much played on the original recordings of those songs. So I was wondering, like, you know how you, what you just said too, you know how you know a song and you could fake your way through it, but that doesn't mean you know it, because I wanted to know that. Did you go back and listen to those records and,
you know? Oh yeah, I definitely did. I mean, I heard those records. Look, I'll be 63 in a couple weeks. So obviously a lot of this music was out when I was a kid. And right. I had an older sister who was 4 years older. They bought all the Motown records and bought Chicago. I mean, I was introduced to Chicago, Temptations, Supremes, all that stuff because of my older sister. So I have to give credit where it's due. So I grew up with that in the household and around me. But it's one thing to know the song, and it's another thing to know the song, to play it as a musician, where you really have to do your homework and take the time to, you know, you have to put the time in. Rehearsal isn't just when you show up. Rehearsal starts at home by listening and being familiar, you know, familiarize yourself with what you're going to play. But one thing I want to point out that Paul Stanley taught me a long time ago, and it had more to do with singing, but I approach it more to like the drumming thing. Paul used to say, Eric, you need to know what you're saying. In other words, you know, you got to sing it so you mean it, and you're really, really singing the song, not just mimicking it, but actually singing it. So know what the topic's about. And I think the same thing applies to all this music. Really learn the part, the original way, the original tempos and all that. That way, when you have that, your point of reference will always be from the original place, not some diluted down version five different bands later. And that's right. What's happened, I noticed, with a lot of these artists. And I'm not saying that as a criticism, it's merely an observation that I went through learning the song. So everybody, all Ray will tell you, we took the time to like learn the songs, the right arrangements, the right vocal harmonies, everything. We try to play them more true to the way they were recorded. A good example, Billy, is that Ooh Child. I didn't even know it was Bernard Purdy until you posted it on Facebook. And I went, oh, well, that explains why it's so cool. And I tried to cop as much as I could of most of the stuff he did because the drum track is so cool. And I never realized, you know, that there's like 30 different versions that have been released of that song over time.
Oh, yeah. Valerie Carter did Jeff Porcaro plays on, because back in the day, Jeff was a big influence. I used to buy any record that Jeff was on. And Valerie Carter, who was also a background singer, God rest her soul. And they did that song on that album. I didn't, you know, Kiss was past. I was never like a huge Kiss fan. I appreciated, you know, the band, but I was never a huge Kiss fan. So now I can't believe that, you know, a solo album by Paul Stanley would be probably one of my favorite albums. I've been listening to it since it came out nonstop, and he did an amazing job because it's hard to do we all know that those songs are the greatest songs, they're classics, they're the greatest songs in the history of music. So right off the bat, you have the song. But giving him credit, the songs that he, original songs that he put on there, I had to think, is that an original song? Or did I never hear this song? It's like,
exactly.
It's so cool that he came up with stuff that even the production, but my point is that record is so good. And of course it has a lot to do with you guys too, as players on it. Production wise, it's just, you usually, if you hear a classic song, you say, nobody's going to do it better than this. So why would I listen to anybody else do it? I would listen to this record and just probably more because it's refreshing and it brings the newness in, but still sounds like the classic. Like once or twice I had to listen to say, is Alexa playing the right song or is she playing the original? You know, that's how good it is. And that's a big thing to say, well, I'll listen to this, you know, as big as this song is a classic and a hit in the history of music, to hear it now and to love it just as much. Yes, it's the song and the production that we all loved back then, but to want to listen to that, I couldn't care if I listened to the original version or this version.
One of the things that blew me away about the record, besides the fact that Paul sings it great and performs it great and did great arrangements, which is the root of it, but from a drummer's perspective, and I mentioned this to you, Eric, before, I said, when I first heard Soul Station, when it was just YouTube videos, and I said, Eric, you sound really authentic. Like, it sounds like the drummers on those records, which has nothing really in common with how you would play with Kiss or Black Sabbath or these other bands you've played with. And you said to me, without missing a beat, no pun intended, you said, I do my homework. I get into the zone and it becomes about what needs to be channeled to get it right. And that's how it sounds. So, you know, share something about that.
I appreciate that, but I got to tell you, Ray, I was going to say, because of guys like Ray and those guys, I knew coming in, these guys are different kinds of musicians, meaning these are yo cats that literally chart stuff out. And I thought, I have to make sure when I show up that I cannot be the odd man. I cannot be the weak link. I have to make sure I've done my homework. So Ray will tell you, you never see a piece of paper or nothing other than a piece of paper with the tempos, because I'll start the tempo with a click track, you know, light, just for reference, but when we're playing live. But other than that, I don't have a piece of paper. I don't have cheat sheets or nothing. It's all here. So I know if anyone's making a mistake or anything, I know when it's right or when it's not, because I've actually put a lot of time in before I come to that first rehearsal, because I felt I owe it out of respect to Ray and Alex and Paul and Hoffa and all the girls. I owe it to them to come prepared. That's just the way I look at it.
And he's absolutely true on that, because he I think you were probably the most prepared, you know, Paul, you know, and then it goes into, well, of course, the horns would come in, you know, for the sessions, the recording sessions, they do their parts separately. But the rhythm section, when we would go in to record the album, like, it was, honestly, we had it, I think each song was probably at the most on the second take.
Yeah. You know,
like, the first take was awesome. It was like, it felt incredible. And then Paula said, let's do it again, just to have another one, you know, have maybe three, maybe.
But I don't think anything ever went past three takes, never. But one thing Paul was adamant about, which I appreciated, see, I like playing with a percussionist because he keeps me honest, meaning he's going to make me play straight ahead, because sometimes you'll have a tendency, you see a hole, hey, I'm going to fill it. And the bottom line is, a percussionist always keeps that continuity of, like, you know, like Derek Sherinian used to play with Buddy Miles, his first gig, and he said, Buddy always told him, you got to hear the train. You know, that chugging along, that shuffly thing that you, like I call it circular. You should always be hearing triplets in your head to keep it, so it sounds and feels round, not square.
True.
I always use the reference of square and round. The percussionist, Ray's going to keep it honest and keep it cool. You know, the percussionist is the glue. So one thing I thought was great, usually a lot of times you add percussion later, which we did on some stuff, but Ray will tell you, Paul wanted the whole band there when we cut the track, meaning he wanted bass, drums, guitar, piano, both keyboards, I should say, and Ray, because it was important to create this kind of sound together so it would be glued together, we could really lock it in. And I'm glad we did it that way, even though we were using a grit track. Sometimes we had to, because Paul had an original tune. We'd all learn it in the morning real quick. We'd run it down with some different parts, talk about it, and then we'd just do it. And every time we did a track, right, Ray, we'd learn it and have the basic track cut in a couple hours.
Yeah. Yeah. We would go into like maybe do one song and be out of there like in an hour and a half. And then Paul would work on vocal stuff. And, you know, but it was like, wow, okay, God, I got the afternoon free now.
But I remember one time, you know, because Paul's very, you know, about, he expects you to be on time. And one time I remember, he's like, Paul, where's Eric? And it's 5 to 10, downbeat's at 10. I'm literally in the parking lot walking through the door as he's calling my phone. And it's like, because he doesn't want you showing up on time. No, he wants you there ready to start on time. There's a difference.
Yeah. Yes. There's a funny story with that too, because I remember the very first rehearsal we did, and Eric was already there. I walked in maybe 30 minutes before the rehearsal. You know, gear's already set up, right? Everybody's in the position, and there's one of the background singers walks in 5 minutes before, and Paul was like, you know, because they're getting stuff out of the bag, and you know, and Paul's like, no, 10 a.m. means 10 a.m. downbeat.
Start.
He's like, start at 10. We start on time.
Which is awesome, because it just showed me how, I mean, like Kiss, you guys still rehearse before a tour. You guys get in the studio and rehearse, you know? And I remember I was texting you and I was like, what's going on? How are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm in a rehearsal with Kiss. And I was like, man, even though you guys, I'm sure, don't have to rehearse, but it's great to get loose again.
But you do have to, because then I tell people, here's the best analogy that I can use, and it's a sports analogy. Would any football team or basketball team not rehearse or not do scrimmaging or play at all and just walk out and play a game? Of course not, because they know, guess what would happen? They'd get hurt, most likely. Mm-hmm. And you would be out of sync, and you wouldn't have, even though they played basketball their whole lives, just like we played some of these songs for 20 or 30 years, point is, It's like you have to go through the muscle memory and the mechanics of doing it, so your brain reminds your body what it feels like to do it, and then it becomes second nature again, and you can get those kind of like aches and pains out of the way. Otherwise, you're gonna struggle.
Yeah, and I'm about the same way. But being professional, man, like always, and this goes back. And Billy, you know this. Every band you work with, there's some. You know, like some groups you've worked with in the past, and all this, they call a 1 p.m. rehearsal, and you're not starting till like 2:15, right. But yet you show up on time. You're the one there, and you're trying to be as professional when other cats are rolling in later. It's like, nah, man, I even in my younger days, I hated that. I was like, no, this is what I want to do. This is what we're supposed to be doing. This is the rehearsal time, 1 to 5, 1 to 4, or 12 to 8, but don't show up late, you know?
Absolutely, and this is the reason why that you guys are as great as you are and as professional as you are, and why you guys worked all these years and made a living out of playing music, because everybody just thinks that, you know, you don't have to put the time and effort into it. It's just one big party, which we all know that that's the furthest thing from the truth. But I wanna go back to like when we were talking about the recording. So Paul, most of the rhythm section recorded live, right? You're saying?
Everything.
Everything. See, now, and that's the way those records were originally recorded. So, like, that automatically gives it closer to what to the original recording. So I like that aspect a lot.
Well, we did it. We did it as an ensemble, it together. We didn't just do like, oh, just bass, drums, and piano or guitar. We did everything, including Ray on percussion. And then sometimes, and the great thing is, as Ray will tell you, everybody's very open-minded to suggestions. So somebody might say, hey, why don't you go and put a combo, or why don't you double up on the tambourine in this section to help it glue it together? And so then Ray would sometimes go back in, and Paul or somebody might have an idea, or Ray might say, I have an idea, let me put this part on it, and maybe build on what he had already put down. But most of the stuff he cut just with us playing like a band. Mind you, yes, we played to a click, but we were playing live and recorded all the instrumentation together. And then of course they brought in the horn sections later, or strings and background vocals separately. But everybody, you know, it was a guide vocal putting down. Because if you're doing an original tune, we don't really know the song. I like to live with stuff a little bit so I kind of feel like I know it, and then I can play it not from just trying to remember where I'm at in the song. I want to play it like I know it, because playing when you know something is a little different attitude than just reading a piece of paper.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's my opinion.
And here's one thing too, that to keep in you know, to understand like where Paul comes from, as Eric, as Billy, you know, as you guys, as Dave, you guys know the importance of the same individuals in the session performing, no subs. It's like, you know, there's no subs because it's a band. It's like Paul and Eric, they come from a band. You know, with Chicago, Chicago's the same way. You don't sub out. This is the band. You know, it's like, I remember Paul told me one time, he goes, I want to turn around and I want to see the same faces all the time. You know, because it's a family, it's a band. He goes like, hey, this is the Soul Station. It's not somebody brand new, oh, hi, you know, a sub, a guitar player, bass, you know, whatever. It's gotta be the band. And I remember the very first gig we did, Eric, I don't know if you remember when Paul said this, at the end of the gig, he turned around and he said, this is too good to not continue. This sounds so good with this band. We can't stop. We just gotta keep doing stuff.
We started off, it all started from Paul. His kids go to a certain school and they do a fundraiser every year. So the first year we did like classic rock stuff, you know, like Free and Zeppelin and Bad Company, whatever. We played cover songs. And so the next year, Paul wanted to do it again. And I think the Foo Fighters played, and because Dave Grohl's kids went to the same school, and then Bush played because the singer of Gavin Rossdale, his kids went to the school. So all these groups were playing for just like the parents out in this field at this school, like in a football field.
That's unbelievable.
Hey, Billy, somebody took a drone and was droning it when the Foo Fighters were on, and tried to stream it on one of those streaming things at the time, because it was a private thing only for parents and stuff. I mean, there's literally only about 150 people there and the Foo Fighters are playing. And anyways.
It was awesome, yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. So anyways, Paul wanted to do something different, so he decided to do the Motown thing, and that's when he said, hey, I really dig this. I want to keep doing this. And, you know, in the very beginning, there were some other different people that originally played, but once he got the group lineup the way it is now, then that's what he just kind of found, I think, what he thought was the vibe and chemistry between the people that he thought, I want to keep this, because I think at one time, Ray, one time you couldn't do a gig, you had somebody fill in for you.
Yeah. Yeah,
but Paul wanted you. I remember
he wasn't happy. You know, it's funny that I saw Paul the day later after the gig, right? And Paul grabs my shoulders and my arms and he just went, "Don't ever do that again to me." I need this band, and I said, "I know." I said, "I couldn't get out of the other thing," and then it was already, you know, already booked, and that was.
Well, we even had some different singers. Remember, we had two of the singers out of the three were originally different, and they had other gigs. I mean, all these people are really great musicians. They play with, you know, Stevie Wonder and whatever, you know, and they, when you gotta go work, you gotta go do whatever your main gig, that's understandable. But once he got settled in with the lineup the way it is on the record, that's what he wanted.
Yeah, it's a cool project. When did he, how long has this been a project?
5 years.
About five years.
Yeah, it's cool.
I got, and you know how I know that is that I got an alert on my phone from Facebook of one of the very first pictures I posted of us at rehearsal. And I was like, wow. I was like, 5 years? Holy crap. I didn't know it was even that long.
So. Amazing. Wait, I have something. I just noticed something. So I'm looking around the room here and I'm looking at Eric. I think we had a sale on Bonham shirts. What are you wearing, Mr. Archivist?
Cool.
This is a bit much. So the Modern Drummer Shop, you can get this Bonham shirt.
I'm getting that one. Yeah.
You mean, this is on the Modern Drummer Shop?
Yes, sir.
I didn't even know that. That's yep. real nice. You see, Eric, you see the way I'm treated? Ray, you see this? Are you guys taking this in? You see the way I'm treated here?
You should be wearing this stuff online when you're doing these interviews like David is. So you're kind of like, you didn't get the memo there, Billy. You're out of uniform.
I didn't even know that we do that. Thank God, because that's not my department and I don't want another department.
Well, Modern Drummer sells these. You have all three styles?
Yes. Yep. So, Eric, you get the John Bonham inaugural issue, July 84, off the top of my head. But the first one, brown cover, very iconic. You get that digitally when you purchase the Bonham package from us.
I remember buying that one. I took the bus to Tower Records just to buy that one in 1984, that issue.
So Eric, wait a minute now, I'm confused here. So Eric, you didn't get that from Modern Drummer?
I bought it from Cardinal Percussion.
Which is who we partnered with Cardinal, and we're selling it at as a special bundle deal with the Bonham issue, but it's all the same, it's from the same place, which is Cardinal. As Eric mentioned offline, Cardinal has a deal with the Bonham estate to bring in licensed merchandise. So we partner with Cardinal, so everybody's doing the right thing. And it's great stuff. I mean, we're huge. We're all huge John Bonham fans.
Ray, that means me and you are going to be getting free shirts.
Yes.
You get half off double retail.
Large.
So Billy.
Hey, you've been in KISS too long.
Cardinal Percussion basically is in Ohio. They distribute Attack drum heads, which I've been using for 25 years or more, and also Wuhan cymbals, and they have the Bonham stuff. They got a couple other products, lug locks, things like that. So I've been working with them forever.
Do you have signature drum heads coming or have them out already?
I do have through Attack. I make a batter and resonant head. That's it. They only make for the snare 14 inch for the snare top and bottom.
What is it? Is it a thin batter? Is it a double layer or what?
Yeah, it's a double layer coated. David, you guys should do a review on it for MD.
100% we should. That's really cool.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's been fine-tuned for rock applications, right?
Yep.
Oh, yeah,
but it's good for a lot of other stuff. Mark should send you guys a few sets so Billy and you guys can put it on your favorite drum, you know, set it up the right way, the way you like, and see what you think.
You have a 14-inch snare batter head and a bottom head.
And a reso. A reso. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Do you use it with Soul Station?
Yep. I use it on all my snares. Cool. But sometimes I'll just go in whatever. For the Soul Station record, I used an old Pearl wood fiberglass kit. So wood shells with fiberglass lining. Real funky tiger stripe color that I found on Reverb about 4 or 5 years ago. But that kit just sounds good to record. It's a 12, 13, 16 standard depth with a 22. And the snare I used on most of it was an older, like the Stuart Copeland kind of snare, the chrome or brass 5-inch Pearl snare from the 70s. They made two drums in that same configuration. One had the parallel throw off, and they called that the Jupiter, but the same shell, same drum with a simple throw off Gladstone type throw strain assembly was also, and they called that just like a rock snare. But you can get that in a 5 or 6.5. But I also used a acrylic Pearl, which the old Pearl ones, like the new ones, were seamless shells. It's a 5x14. It's kind of a amber mango colored one that I found online years ago. And I used that also recording. It sounds great. So I actually used all Pearl stuff on this and Zildjian cymbals. But I used like ambassador type weight coated heads, and you know, we just went for more of a, you know, more rounder, warmer 70s type sound, if you will.
Eric, did you know that that James Gadsden, he still has, he used on a lot of those classic soul records that James Gadsden played on, he used a fiberglass kit. Did you know that that was used on a lot of some of that original recordings?
No, but this one's a wood fiberglass, which a little different than the fiberglass. I mean, live, I used fiberglass kits the last couple of years with Kiss. Those all those kits with the mirror ball wrapping, those are 70s fiberglass shells. And I'm using a Phenolic President series snare drum live with Kiss. And I use that sometimes. I've used that also with Soul Station. It's Phenolic material, which is like a plastic fiber type synthetic material that Pearl came out with in the late 60s. And they just reintroduced it for a 75th anniversary kit. So you can get those drums again, but I think it's very limited. I think there's only 75 or 100 kits being made of the Phenolic, which is basically, it's similar to like Bakelite. The best way to try to explain to people what the material is, if you look at a circuit board from old radios and stuff, that's what the material is. Phenolic is basically a resin-based material that is similar to circuitry, circuit boards.
Wow. Well, and speaking of Pearl, congrats to Pearl, Modern Drummer, me and David, and all of us, we send our congratulations on 75 years. That's a biggie.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's pretty crazy. That's pretty crazy they've been in business that long of a time. And they've really, you know, now you get anything you want. If you really want, the great thing is, I'm not trying to over pitch for them, but I'm just, the great thing I like about them, you can get anything, whatever your mind can imagine, they'll make it for you if you want to spend the money and have the patience to wait for it.
Right, right. So, Ray, what's coming up? I know, like, I'm sure you guys would have been on the road. Any talk of when maybe some shows might come back, or everybody waiting till next year?
No, well, right now we have, with Chicago, we have dates beginning in June.
Yeah, so, really.
You have a Vegas date.
Have a what?
You have a Las Vegas date.
September. We got Vegas, like a 4 nights in Vegas. But the, if you go to chicagotheband.com, there's dates listed beginning in June. Let's see how they stick. You know. Let's see what's happening. Right now, we're recording a new album. There's a lot of tunes that have been submitted, and the ones that I've heard and played on are pretty incredible.
Any Soul Station dates coming up?
I don't know about anything at the time yet, but you know, we did go, you know, we went to Japan. For a lot of people don't know, we went and did 10 shows there a couple of years ago, which was very cool. I mean, it was a lot of work because we were like, we did 2 shows a night, like old school style, right, Ray?
Yeah, that was wow.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Two shows a night, and one after the other. Did you have days off?
No, we did 2 shows a night, 3 in a row, 1 day off, and the same thing 3 days. So we did 10 shows in 7 days.
Yeah,
that's 12 shows.
12, yeah. 12.
So we did 10. There was a day off.
No, but then you did 3 and 3.
Then we did 12, I guess. I guess my bad. Yeah, we did 3. We did 12, right, Ray?
Yeah, in 2 cities too.
Two cities.
Yeah. And then, you know, the album is like, the last I heard, it's number 8 in Japan right now.
That's fantastic. Now it deserves, I mean, I wish there was radio stations here. I mean, of course on Sirius that, you know, they're going to play it, and streaming, you know, but that stuff would be on all the Soul Stations. I've been listening to the Soul Station lately on Sirius. It's become one of my favorites, you know, because we all grew up on all that stuff. So it's,
you know, it's funny. Earlier, Billy, you mentioned how about the comparison to the original material versus the covers we did. And yes, it is a beautiful compliment what you said. And you know who said exactly the same thing? Paul was telling me last week. He was having a conversation with Richard Marx, and Richard mentioned one of the songs. He said, who played this song? I can't remember who the artist is. And Paul said, that's an original song. That's one of the ones I wrote. And how beautiful is that, though? You know?
Yeah, no, that's the greatest compliment. I mean, yeah, because he he showed that, like, you know, he really, it's his heart and soul, obviously, yeah. But it's his heart and soul put into this, to this project. It's not just like, hey, let me try this out, you know, let me check this out. You know, he did an excellent job. It's a great record. We all love it. We thank you guys for taking the time to talk about it with us. And you know, hats off to Paul. And it's a surprise, because, you know, like I said, people are going to be, and that's always, the element of surprise is always the best thing, you know. Sure. And it wasn't hyped before it came out. So, because when you hype something, you know what it's like. If you hype something too much, no matter how great it is, there's always a little letdown. You know, he just put out, when I heard Ooh Child, that was it. I was hooked. I was like, and at first I didn't even know it was Paul. I was just like, oh, this is really good. And then I found out it was Paul, and I was like, I had to keep looking at the credits and try to, you know, it's just, he did a great job. So hats off to all you guys.
And speaking about gear, when you guys were talking about the about Eric's kit, you know, I had to look at my setup as well to think, I gotta go old school sound on the percussion, especially with the tambourine. You know, I can't just grab a new tambourine from a stack of LPs that I have. So I had to get the brass jingle older LP tambourine that I had.
The wooden ones, right? The wooden ones.
Yeah, the wooden ones. Exactly.
The wood ones, yeah.
The ones that don't have that indentured, so it's comfortable on your hand. It's just all one piece, right? Back in the day, right? But brass
jingle. You gotta work on those too. Those
yeah,
things.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, if you're not used to playing.
It's that one hit on the tambourine that has a natural reverb on it, where you don't have to add anything to it. And I remember Greg Collins, our engineer, he was like, dude, that's the perfect tambourine. I said, I know, and I only use it for sessions. I really don't use it for live. And then for the congas, I went with the LP, the Raul Rakau signature series, because it's a New Zealand wood, which is a very warm sound, which was very similar to the congas back then. Because if I would have gone fiberglass, it would have been too tingy and poppy, you know, and even plastic heads do not work for this style of music at all. It has to be the regular skin, you know, the regular skin. So, you know, like Eric, you had to, you know, we did our homework on gear as well. And that just comes natural. Yeah, I wasn't thinking about it. I just thought, okay, sound wise, hitting the drum, I got to grab this on these drums instead. And, you know, and it's funny, that day, I think day one, I had two different sets of congas in the car, making sure that if one didn't work, I grabbed the other one instead and bring it in. But
see,
yeah,
but Ray wanted to make sure they matched my drums.
Yeah, the black ones, right?
And I think Ray's making a good point about, you know, I've always had a point of view, which I think sometimes people forget about with drums and drummers in particular. Think about other musical instruments and the materials that they're made out of. So I always have this point of view that you should use musical sounding materials. I mean, what are they using? Saxophones and trumpets and all that? Brass, right? Sometimes silver, but mostly brass. So you think people used to use brass, you know, chrome plated brass rims and brass shells, and more like, or even pearl for a while, use stainless steel hoops, which sounded great. So using music type materials, if you will, in the manufacturing of drums and percussion instruments, I think is very important, because those metals and woods have a more musical sound, and you really hear it when you're in a studio more under the microscope, and how it works with certain types of music. In a live setting, you're looking for projection and volume, and you can get away with stuff being like Ray said, fiberglass congas and a plastic tambourine, because you need to be able to really hit it, and you're looking for projection, you're competing with a lot of volume. But in a studio, you're going for warmth and real tones. So
that's great. I've never heard anybody explain it that complicated, but yet that simple, because that's true. I'm not a gear guy, so I never really, you know, I usually just hit something. If I like it, I like it. If I don't, I don't. But I love the way you explain that, because that makes a lot of sense.
A lot of people don't know this. I actually worked at King Instruments in the early 80s for about 3.5 years, making trumpets, saxophones, you know, tubas, and all the brass instruments. I was a welder, like actually with a oxyacetylene torch. It's brazing. You don't weld. Like, people think of arc welding when they think of welding, but brazing is a form of welding. But I basically worked there making instruments for 3.5 years. So you realize they're using silver or brass to make an instrument. You realize, why do they use those materials? Because they have the best musical tonality properties for making instruments. Just like wood, they try to choose it for guitars. You know, and for the, you know, they use even the neck fretboards. They choose types of wood that have helped with the instrument sounding better. That's why I used to use Brazilian rosewood until it got outlawed.
No, that's a great thing. Thanks for that.
I would say the more musical materials you use, the better. You see how some guys get analytical about the lug and the tuning rods and using washers and gaskets, so you create, you know, less transmission of you know, unwanted vibration rather than the wanted kind. And there's a reason why older wood drums sometimes sound better. It's just, I think a lot has to do with the aging of the wood, but also the molecular structure. Every time somebody's hitting it, if somebody's playing music with an instrument and they're playing it with, I think there's some spirituality to the emotion they put into playing that instrument, that it gets that, you know, we call it mojo. Why do we call it mojo? We just know it sounds good, and usually it's mojos usually associated with more older vintage type instruments, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you've been to Eric, you've been to the museum, right? When you do those rolls around Hal Blaine's original kit, it just automatically sounds like Hal Blaine. It's just like, no matter who does that Hawaii 5-0 roll, it sounds like Hal Blaine.
Yeah great. A lot of guys wanted that. Hey, you know something? I use fiberglass drums the last couple of years because of exactly what you're talking about. You hear that sound in your head.
You know, Eric reminded me of, we were in the studio, and I forgot which song, Eric, but it's a tune where you hit the floor tom with the snare.
What
song? I can't remember what song it is, that with the Soul Station, but.
Could it be I'm falling in love?
It might be that one. I'm not sure. But I was doing some overdubs, right? And then Eric came in and Eric said, do like double my floor tom part on something so we can, it just sounds thicker, you know? And so instead of using, I think, remember the studio, Dave's room?
Dave's place.
They had a kit in the back, an old kit. So I grabbed that floor tom. And with a mallet, I was just along with Eric hitting it. But it was so cool because I did it in one take, and knowing Eric's playing as well, there was no flam. It was just boom, you know, listening back to it, you know. And it felt, and that was Eric's idea, like just hit it, just to make it a little thicker, a little more a foundation with it, you know.
I'm sure it gave it another tone too. It gave it, you know, because you didn't want it to sound exactly the same, but exactly. You did want that oomph.
Exactly. And I think, well, it might have been an 18-inch floor tom versus you have a 16, right? In that room.
Only a 16, yeah.
So it might have been a little bit, yeah, definitely.
But,
a little,
you know, like sometimes they have double, you know, listen to Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life, and there's two drummers on that record. You have to really put on headphones to focus. But Stevie Wonder is one of the drummers, which a lot of people don't even know that as well. But, you know, you could clearly hear somebody playing a different part. It was very common in the old days for people to double track drums and put a second slightly part. And you'll hear a little flamming once in a while, but it gives it character. But it creates this, you know, this foundational, like, wall. You know, it's the Phil Spector wall of sound thing by double. Yeah. You know, a lot of times you'd have two bass players, two guitar players.
Right, yeah.
He wanted that thickness that's created. And as opposed to just overdubbing a bunch of stuff, he'd record it with, like, simultaneously.
You know, I'm a big fan of double drumming and playing with a percussion player. I mean, my whole life I felt naked if I wasn't. And that's why when the drum machine came out, I embraced it, and I loved the drum machine for that main reason. You know, to just put the shaker on 16ths and the tambourine on 2 and 4 without hearing it.
Yeah.
You know, lately, I've been years of the habit of doing, when I record here at home, and I got to do, you know, majority of the time there's a shaker track, right? So I'll sometimes shaker dead center, and then I'll do a shekere, pan it a little bit to the left, and then maracas to the right, kind of doing the similar pattern, but with little nuances here and there, just to give it more of the train vibe, you know. And I always put that in the notes to, you know, any of you producers out there listening. It's pan the shakere, pan the maracas, but leave the shaker dead center. So it's like coming at you like this, right? And it sounds so nice, man. Especially with
the hi-hat, yeah. With the hi-hat is like so.
That alone, sometimes that's all it needs. That's all the track needs, you know. And I always listen to make sure not too much congas, you know, don't want to get, unless it needs it, you know, like what we did. There was a couple of songs that did not need congas on this album, and it was just more tambourine, shaker, groove stuff, and that was it, you know. Which I remember listening back going, Paul, I don't think it needs congas, and he's like, okay, cool, let's move on to the next one.
Yeah, why force something? And look, even back in the day of the Beatles, I mean, when you know, back then you didn't even pay attention to the percussion. But then as you got into that and observed those recordings, and now especially the tambourine parts and the little bits of percussion that they had in some of those songs, the groove would never have been the same if it wasn't for that percussion.
I remember Ringo saying at one point in the making of Sgt. Pepper, Ringo's like, and the band wanted congas on it. And he goes, I'm not a percussionist. And he goes, and my hands were hurting because I had to play conga drums. And he played great what he played though, man.
But I got to tell you though, the one thing I've learned, Ray, and I've done this before, you know, could I play some of the percussion parts if I had to? There was nobody else there to do it. I'd be like, yeah. But I've learned that guys that play percussion for real, I mean, that's what they do. It's a completely different technique. And they know how to get the sound and the evenness the right way. That's why you bring them in. So I'm smart. You know, they say a smart person knows what they do and they know what they don't do. And I remember doing a Kiss record years ago, and we brought Luis Conte in, because I said, bring in this guy, bring in Luis, because, you know, he's a real percussionist. He's going to give it the right feel, the right placement, and where it needs it. And also the point of view, which is the most important thing of all. Percussionist is going to, if they've done a lot of work, they're going to go, no, I don't think this will work this well. Let me try this. Let me show them. And you go, oh, wow, that's really cool. And so I remember we did Carnival Souls record. We brought Luis Conte in to do all the percussion upon my suggestion, because I thought, you know, in fact, when we did one album with Bob Ezrin, I had Bob Ezrin do all the percussion because he was good. He was, you know what it is? He was really even. He just had the right technique with the tambourine. He'd obviously done it many, many times. I thought, you're better than me at it. You know, I can see somebody else needs to do it that does it better than me. And that's good.
And tambourine, Jack Ashford, right from the Motown. I mean, tambourine playing, people think that, you know, so anybody could play tambourine. No way. You know how many background singers I would have to take the tambourine away from them because they were completely throwing off my group. Yeah. I was like, yeah, no, that's okay. Please don't play the tambourine.
I know. Oh, yeah. You know what? I was doing, check this out. I was doing a gig with Aretha Franklin, right? And we're sound checking. This is at not the Staples Center, the Nokia Theater in LA. And I, you know, I pull out the tambourine and put it on the percussion table. And this girl comes over to me, one of the band, the original, her band members, right? Because it was her band member with some LA guys. So she comes over to me, she goes, honey, no, I got the tambourine parts. She goes, you do everything but the tambourine. And I said, oh, okay, all right, I'm cool. And then she opened up her case. She had a case of four different tambourines. She was only the tambourine player. She was not a background singer. She was the tambourine player. That's it. And I'm talking, she went gospel on a bunch of tunes, and that's a whole different, and I was like, okay, yes, you do have the tambourine.
Yeah, no. In the Motown, I mean, that Motown, that made that Motown sound, the way he turned his hand. I mean, you do it, of course, Bashiri Johnson. I mean, you know, Walfredo and Danny, his brother. I mean, because there's an art to that. That you don't just start, shaking the tambourine.
Well, one of my favorite tunes of that whole era is Reflections. Is it the Supremes? Is that by the Supremes? If you listen to the beginning of it, it starts with the tambourine. And that groove and the sound of that tambourine is like so beautiful, man. It's like that is the 70s right there. I'm sure.
And they usually had a head. They usually had a skin. So like in Day Tripper, that tambourine in Day Tripper is a major part.
Who played? Did Ringo play that one?
I believe he did, yeah.
Okay. Because I know they all jumped on drums at one point.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ringo always used to say, John used to bring in records all the time in George that were Motown records. And Ringo would, they wanted him to copy, and Ringo would try to tell them there's two drummers on there. And they'd be like, don't worry about it. You could do it.
Yeah.
That's the point I was getting to before. A lot of times there's double drumming or stacked up drumming, and then you have to decide what's the integral or the main thing that pulsar that you're getting from the drum section, because you only got four limbs, you need eight, so you have to kind of figure it out of what's going to cover the most bases. But having a percussionist is what usually does it.
Yeah, and the percussion, that's the magic dust that that's the magic dust that adds a lot of flavor and taste to music. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Well, something, when the drums are moving around, the old records, they didn't use click tracks, so the time's kind of going around in spots. Having that tambourine, a great tambourine player will lock in throughout the track, and they will glue it together and make it feel seamless and make the drummer sound better and make the band sound better. It really does.
Absolutely.
It's the special dust, like you said.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I want to thank you guys so much for doing this.
Honored.
Yeah, honored to have you both here today. And I'm happy we got to do this. And everybody should definitely check out the Paul Stanley album. It's called Now and Then. Paul Stanley Soul Stations, Now and Then. And
don't forget to get it on vinyl and special purple vinyl, David.
We've got a copy of the Soul Station purple vinyl. I love the fold-out Paul Stanley and Soul Station. Amazing job. This is like so much fun. This is what it feels like to have a record again. And it sounds great. You guys look great. So thank you. Our archivist, Mr. Felipe Laverde, had the purple vinyl. So thank you, Mr. LePew.
Right on. Great. Excellent. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Billy. Thanks, David. Thanks, Ray. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you guys. Modern Drummer. Modern Drummer.
Everybody, don't forget to go to Modern Drummer shop and get your bottom shirts. Right, David?
Yes, there you go. There you go. Billy,
and don't forget to send one to Billy.
Yeah, and Ray. I mean, come on.
And Ray, of course. Thank you guys for Modern Drummer.
Gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, we'll get it together and we'll get it all done. Someday. Yeah.
gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
So everybody, stay healthy, stay strong, keep drumming, and we'll see you next time on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.